tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. It's just over halfway through this year's Range Retreat, so the best half is yet to come. And for this talk this evening, I wanted to encourage the deepening of the meditation practice, encouraging the greater brightness of the mind by talking about the five hindrances. Those of you who haven't got jhana yet this retreat, it means it's the five hindrances, fault. And so often it's very useful in one's meditation practice not just to sit there and just make the same mistakes over and over again and get frustrated, but to use the teachings of the Buddha, especially in terms of the five hindrances, to analyze the situation and see what the faults are. See why it is that the mind doesn't become peaceful. To try and find out what one is doing wrong, or rather what the wrong attitude is, and how to amend that wrong attitude, that wrong perception. Because as many great teachers say, that the meditation is very easy. It's only the hindrances make it hard. It's nothing to do with one's ability. It's more to do with these hindrances blocking the path. If we don't recognize those hindrances, we don't know them very well, and we don't know how to overcome them, then of course our meditation practice will never be all that successful. So we're going to talk once again about these five hindrances. I'm sure that most of you know their names, even in Pali. I'm going to go through them briefly and then go in detail about what their meaning is and how to recognize them and how to overcome them. The five hindrances are Kamachanda, Vyapada, Tinamida, Udaccha Kukaccha and Vichikicchara. The Kamachanda is the that interest, involvement in the world of the five senses. And Vyapada is ill will, and Tinamida is the sloth and torpor. Udaccha Kukaccha is the restlessness and remorse, and Vichikicchara is the doubt. These are the things which can manifest as obstacles to the deepening of meditation. If we use a simile which I was using at lunchtime, one of Ajahn Chah's beautiful similes, one can see just how these five hindrances work. The simile was that of a leaf on a tree, and it's the nature of a leaf on a tree to be still. In fact, right at this moment there's no wind blowing, so I'm sure that most of the leaves on the trees outside are absolutely still. And they only move, they only vibrate, they only go backwards and forwards because of winds. In the same way that this mind of ours is still, its nature is to be peaceful, its nature is to just be there, stopped. However, because of the winds that this mind moves, and you can look upon those winds as the five hindrances. The hindrance of sensory interest, blowing the mind this way and that in search for the pleasures of the senses. Of ill will, blowing the mind away from the object of the ill will. The tinamida, just this wind just blowing this mind into a sense of dullness and stupor, just like in a fog. And the restlessness and worry, the gales, the storms which blows backwards and forwards, and the vichikicchara, the the wind's now blowing this way, now blowing that way, not really knowing which way it's supposed to be blowing. Like a whirlwind, just going round and round and round in circles, never getting anywhere. But these are winds which make our mind vibrate. And if we could only just avoid those five hindrances, if we can just notice them and sidestep them, then the mind will settle down all by itself. As I've been saying throughout this retreat, naturally, without you having to force it to quieten down, it will go into stillness beautifully, gently, gracefully, and it will stay in that stillness for long periods of time. So we need to be able to recognize these five hindrances as our enemies. The first hindrance, I always say, is one of the greatest, the interest in the sensory world, the five-sense world. And it's not just in the coarser forms of sensuality, like food or sex or romance or not even in movies and music, which is the problem, because many people can recognize those as obstacles. It's sometimes the more refined aspects of sensuality which causes us an obstacle to making the mind peaceful, which stop us letting go of the body with its five senses. Whatever obstructs the letting go is a hindrance, is an obstacle. In this particular case, the concern for the sensory world just stops us from letting go of the body and the sight, sound, smell, sight, hearing, smell, taste and touch. We're just too interested in it. As the fire sermon, which we just chanted a few moments ago, says very eloquently, that all these senses are on fire. And if we can only develop this sense of nibbida, this sense of repulsion or revulsion from that world of the five senses, it would overcome very quickly the hindrance of sensory concern. It's almost as if that you see that this body, the smell, the taste, the hearing, the seeing, is all on fire with these things. And anything which is on fire, the only thing to do is just to run out of that burning house. Running out of that burning house is what nibbida is, just leaving it alone, letting it go, going somewhere else, escaping. That nibbida is what undermines your hope for any satisfaction or contentment, you know, in that world of the five senses. It's very important to overcome that hindrance of sensory concern with the mindfulness on the body. Because when we do mindfulness on the body, it's just not mindfulness of the physical senses, you know, the sense of touch. But with this body is always connected the sight, sound, smell and taste as well. This is all body stuff. And if we could only develop that mindfulness of the body and just see this body for what it is, and see smell and taste for what it is, to see sight and sound for what it is, just rising and passing away, just giving us more business, more things to do. I know some years ago that we were joking, it would be wonderful if some scientist could just invent a pill with all the vitamins and proteins and carbohydrates you would need for the day. So you can just every morning, the anagarikas could offer each monk a pill in their bowl, and they could just put that pill in their mouth and swallow it and have done with all of this food business, of trying to make it delicious, trying to make it enough, wondering about the dharma. Wouldn't it be wonderful just to have a pill to take? Even you can make it so it lasts 7 days or something. Whatever it was, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to overcome this concern about taste or smell? I am very fortunate in one sense, even though this time of the year I suffer from hay fever. It means very often my nose is blocked and so you don't smell people. It's one of the senses I don't need to worry about so much. However, that by doing a lot of mindfulness on the body, contemplation of the body, it's there to see the futility of seeking any happiness in that world of the five senses. Each one of you has been on this planet, in this life, long enough now to have searched for happiness in that realm, and I'm sure that each one of you have found that it's not to be gained. The happiness in the world is just ephemeral. Whatever you get just passes away just far too quickly. If happiness does come, it's just like a flash of lightning, gone in a moment, leaving just darkness for a long time afterwards. This is just the nature of the sensory world, the five sense world. By doing mindfulness of the body, you're actually uncovering the futility of this search and how stupid it is to seek for satisfaction and happiness in that realm. You see that this body is, as the Buddha said, just full of pain and full of sores. It's never going to be comfortable. Even now as you're sitting listening to me, there's probably already enough aches and pains, cold and heat, stomach aches, headaches, back aches, or whatever else ache. This is already there in this body. Don't think this is something wrong with this, that this is something unusual. This is the nature of the body to be this way. And no matter how much you try to heal the pains and difficulties of the body, you'll only be able to heal it temporarily, and it will come back again, even worse. It's the nature of the body to be that way. Whatever pleasure you get from this body, it's outweighed by old age, sickness and death. So there's a sense of futility comes for trying to look for pleasure in this body. If you're realistic and contemplate properly with yonisamanasikara, just with the work of the mind going back to the source, you see that the whole movement of the mind which tries to seek happiness, pleasure, delight, even comfort in this world is bound for failure. And it's such a unfortunate waste of your time. And you can see that the only time the body has been happy, at least in my experience in 49 years in this life, the only time my body has been happy is when I've let it go in deep meditation. All the other times it's irritation. Even pleasure is an irritation. It irritates me by giving me more business. I've got to try and maintain this pleasure, or when it disappears, to find something else to replace it. It's a constant demand of attention, work, striving. In fact, so many people just probably even haven't gone home from work this evening yet, just because of the search for pleasure in this body, for comfort, for fulfillment of the five sense world. It creates so much work, so much problem. And sometimes after a while you just get fed up with that world. You want to leave it alone. No matter how big you make your house, no matter how many wives or husbands you have, how many mistresses, how many toy boys, how many places you go to, music you listen to, food you eat, it's never satisfying. You find out when, by mindfulness of the body, when is your body satisfied? It's only when the attention goes elsewhere, when the body disappears, when it's gone. If you can reflect upon the danger of following the sensory world, the five sense world, you reflect upon the idiocy of trying to find any satisfaction in seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, then that will give you the right view, the right attitude in order to abandon this great hindrance. You'll only be able to give up sensory concerns only if you want to, if you see the danger. In the old simile which I use very frequently of the Chinese general, the one who had the perfect discipline in the army, he would only be able to have perfect discipline because he'd only tell the troops to do what they wanted to do, because he'd conditioned them, he'd encouraged them to do those duties of a soldier, so that when he ordered them, they wanted to do what he told them. In the same way, the only way you can let go of that sensory world is to convince yourself of the dangers of that sensory world and the benefits of letting it go. In the same way that a person can give up smoking only if they really want to, only if they've convinced themselves of the dangers of smoking. Only then can they give it up. In the same way, if you can convince yourself of the dangers of the sensory realm, then you can give it up. And it's enough information which you have already, enough experience which you've had already, enough reality you've known to be able to give up that five sense realm. So it means that when you're sitting in meditation, you don't allow the mind to go thinking about sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches, either real ones or imagined ones, because you know, you've convinced yourself already through your mindfulness on the body and the five senses which it contains. You've already understood completely, thoroughly, there'd be no happiness to be found there. So you don't send your mind thinking about such things. If there's even any ache or pain in the body, you don't send your mind thinking about those things. You know it's futile. If a mosquito lands on you, you don't bother about it. It's futile trying to get rid of it. You can't squash it. If you nudge it away, it'll just go and bite you somewhere else. So two irritations in the place of one. So that sense, that common sense, that wisdom, that insight will allow you to overcome all concerns for the five senses. So if that is your hindrance, if you're still planning about food or sex or music or thinking what to do after the rains retreat, all those sorts of five sense fantasies, dreams, then just know that you're wasting a lot of time. Know that it's futile, it will never give you any satisfaction and happiness. And just abandon that. Don't be concerned with it. What you're unconcerned with, what you take away any sense of value towards, disappears. The mind will only be concerned with what it thinks is valuable, what it thinks is important. So know that world, know its futility, and put your value somewhere else. And every time that you do gain some freedom from the body in meditation, when the body disappears, when we get to that stage called kaya passadi, the tranquility of the body, where all the body disappears as it were, and you just really don't know where the body is. When you get to those sorts of stages, just notice and remember just how satisfying, how peaceful, how happy it is to have let go of this body. It's as if you're keeping on telling the mind, look mind, look mind, look mind. When you give up the five senses, if you give up the body even in this coarser form, it's happiness, it's stillness, it's peace. Look mind, and please remember. Please remember. So you are actively reconditioning yourself. You're reconditioning yourself to abandon all concern for that five sense world. And every time it is abandoned, always remember to do that, because it makes it easier to abandon the five sense world next time. When that five sense world is completely abandoned, that's when things like nimittas appear. To fully abandon that hindrance is extremely difficult unless one is an anagami. So that's why there is a very well-worn path to letting go of the five sense world gradually. You let it go stage by stage, letting go of most of the five sense world and just staying with the sense of touch, using something like the breath as the last of the five senses to rest your attention on, until you can even let that one go. When the breath disappears, that's when all the five senses are gone, and karma chanda has been overcome. Remember, the word chanda means like your consent, interest, desire, will for that world. That's what karma chanda means. It's an underlying movement of the will towards that world. And why do we move towards that world? Why is that? Because we still are convinced that there's something for us to be found there. That's why only through such reflection of the dangers of that world, and the beauty, the peace, the satisfaction when that world disappears, only those reflections can truly overcome that will, that consent, that desire for those things. And once that has been overcome, then just the mind doesn't even incline towards the five sense world. Doesn't really worry so much about what it eats. Doesn't really worry so much about beautiful bodies, sounds, smells, or whatever. You can let all those go simply because it's not interested anymore. The will, the chanda, the desire is gone. So see if you can abandon that desire, and you find that these things just do not bother you at all. The second hindrance of ill will, again, is a great problem for many meditators. I think, as you've heard me teach before, that ill will can be in many areas. It can be ill will towards a person, ill will towards yourself, or even ill will towards a meditation object, what you're doing. Each one of those aspects of why a part of ill will should be really reflected upon. First of all, to people in the outside world, anyone other than you, that ill will towards other people is completely stupid and meaningless. It's none of your business what other people do. As Ajahn Chah would often say in his monastery, at the very, 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 very most, you should only look at people 5% of the time. Look at yourself 95% of the time. Don't care what other people are up to. You just do your job, do your duties, quietly, gently, with kindness, and just look upon yourself. Trouble with vayapada, with ill will towards another person. When we have ill will towards someone else, we're not looking at ourselves anymore, we're looking at them. We're blaming them for our suffering. The old victim psychology, it's somebody else's fault, it's his fault, it's her fault. That's completely un-Buddhist. It's not wise, it's not true, and most importantly, it's very harmful. So at the very least, we should be able to overcome the ill will towards other people. Certainly in this monastery, the standard of people in this monastery is so high that it's beyond me to see how anyone can have ill will towards a person in this monastery. Because none of you are deserving of even the slightest bit of ill will. Maybe out there in the big bad world, there are some really bad people around. But everyone in this monastery has got such a good heart. So it's got such a pure standard of conduct. That it's very hard to find ill will towards people here. It's much more easy to get inspiration from all the people here, by the standard of their conduct, the standard of their renunciation, living the monastic life. So by focusing on those high, beautiful qualities in a person, it's very easy to overcome ill will towards others. And you should at least be able to do that much, to live like as an island to oneself, not really so concerned with what other people do. But when it gets towards ill will towards oneself, that for Westerners is very deeply ingrained in them for one reason or another. And the only way to really overcome that is through the practice of metta and loving kindness towards oneself. And again, that can be such a huge obstacle to meditation. It's as if one doesn't allow oneself happiness. One has this sort of self-destructive attitude towards oneself. I don't deserve happiness. Or even it comes to, I can't do this. You know, other people may be able to get into deep meditation, but not me. So much of that comes from ill will towards oneself. That hardness, that harshness. And as of course you've heard many times, that attitude of mind of hardness, harshness, is not the way to develop deep meditation. It's not the path which leads to insight. It doesn't lead to nibbana. This path is a path for the soft mind, the gentle mind, the generous mind, the mind which can let go and let be, and allow problems to disappear and dissolve. So it is important for each one of us to practice some degree of metta, loving kindness meditation, towards ourselves, to give ourselves trust, to give ourselves confidence, to develop that degree of faith in ourselves. Because that indriya of sadha also overcomes that ill will towards ourselves. Once you have overcome that ill will towards yourself, the path is open to have happiness, to have joy. And remember, it's only from happiness, from joy, that samadhi occurs. And the old Sukhino Jitang Samadhiati, from happiness the mind enters samadhi. So somehow or other we have to develop that happiness in our monastic life. And developing happiness in monastic life is overcoming that ill will towards ourselves. So be kind towards yourself, be gentle towards yourself. Treat yourself as your mother would treat you. Just like a mother loves her only child. I mean, like a nice, kind mother, a gentle mother, a loving mother. Encourage yourself, but don't force yourself. And with that gentle encouragement, as you'd expect from a Buddha, you make the fastest of progress. And the Kuba Ajahn, the great teachers I knew, were all kind and encouraging. And the rumours or the the reputation of some of these of being really, really fierce, that was only a fraction of their conduct. It was only the bad disciples sort of met the fierce Ajahn Mahabhoas or the fierce Ajahn Mans. Many of the teachers which I taught with, when they talked about people like Ajahn Man, they say he was the most kind and encouraging person. Just full of loving kindness. And I've mentioned before, you know, encounters with Ajahn Mahabhoa, where he was just so soft and gentle. And the softest and gentlest person I've ever met in my life. And that was a great teaching for me, to see that. Because it showed me the power of that loving kindness to get rid of the ill will. To inspire and encourage and energize, which overcomes that negativity in one's meditation. So often, especially this time in the retreat, you know you've got nothing else to do except to sit and walk meditation. We've designed this monastery that way. There's no avenues of escape this time of the year. You just have to sit, you have to walk, unless you want to sleep all day. There's hardly any books to read, only suttas, and you soon get bored with them if you're not into the Dhamma. There's nothing else to do, and so sometimes, very easy, we're forcing ourselves to meditate out of ill will. We don't really want to meditate. We really don't really want to watch the breath. And that becomes the biggest obstacle. That's why apada, that's ill will. Ill will towards the meditation object, ill will towards the process. Ill will towards the Eightfold Path. Very easy to arise, but so damaging to the practice. Notice that one if it's in you, and see if you can overcome it very quickly. Again, just like the Chinese general, just turn your view around. Use reflection. Use your wisdom, use your insight to realize that this path of meditation is a beautiful way. And it is in your interest to do this. Brainwash yourself. If you find it very, very difficult to meditate, then get a blank tape and just record it. I want to meditate, I want to meditate, and play it during your sleep. Whatever it is which brainwashes you, conditions you, or whatever, to really want to meditate, to want to watch the breath. With that encouragement, which I can do a little of, but you can do most of, you find when you sit down, your mind inclines towards the meditation object. It's as if you can't wait to get back after your meal, to get and sit down, whoopee, meditation. It's like watching your favourite movie on the TV. It's like going to the office for the reading room for the Guardian newspaper. You can't wait to get it first. Be the first one to read the breath and to get into meditation. When you have that sort of degree of inclination towards the breath, when you love the meditation object, then you can say you've really overcome the ill will towards that. And it happens, and after a while you just love meditating, and you just can't get enough of it. You're sitting in your hut, and instead of writing letters, you want to meditate, and all your mail piles up. At least that's a good sign. The sign that you're making the meditation much more important. That you're loving the meditation. You see, what people love in the world is what they spend most time doing. They love doing their hobbies. They love, you know, going to their footy or films or whatever. As monks, we have to develop that love for the meditation. And we can develop that inclination. Only when we have that can we really say that we've overcome ill will towards a meditation object. That is such a huge obstacle. Once it's overcome, meditation becomes so easy. The reason? Because as soon as one meditates, one puts one's full attention on what one is doing. If you have ill will towards a meditation object, you're only half there. The other half is, you know, trying to get it out of the way. So none of this is going to be wrong, it's going to hurt, it's not going to be nice. So you're not really fully into it. You're not giving it full effort. You're not even giving it full attention. You're just waiting for an excuse to do something else. That ill will always be blowing you away. Blowing you away from the goal, blowing you away from the Dhamma, blowing you away from the Eightfold Path. Be very careful of that. Notice it if it's there, ill will towards a person, ill will towards yourself, ill will towards a meditation object. See if that's there. And use some of these methods to overcome that hindrance. The hindrance of Tina Mida, of sloth and torpor, just the lack of energy, the lack of brightness. The physical energy is overcome just by putting in effort. Again, overcoming vyapada is very important, because when you've got ill will, especially towards the meditation object, especially towards, you know, the retreat or whatever, you just don't want to get up early in the morning, you don't want to have energy. When you overcome the vyapada, it's quite easy to gain energy. Those people who don't like life sleep a lot. As the prisoners at Karna used to say, just one extra hour's sleep is 1 hour off the sentence. And sometimes that's what people feel. One extra hour's sleep is 1 hour off the retreat, if you're having a hard time. And sometimes it's so easy to get into that pit which gets deeper and deeper and deeper, of ill will and depression and lack of energy and dullness. It's a terrible place to be in. The wise person knows that energy is happiness, physical energy. And the only way to arouse that is actually doing what is hard to do. Because it's easy to lay in the morning and sleep a bit longer. Instead, jump out and get out of bed early. and see what happens. Now don't just sit up with the blankets still around you. Throw them off and go outside. Do push-ups or whatever. Greet the morning, jump up and down, do walking. Walk backwards or whatever. Do something which actually gets the energy going. Once you get into the habit of getting up early and arousing energy, you feel so much better. So much better about yourself, you've got much more time. You find you don't need so much sleep. If you get up earlier, very often, you find you've got energy for the day, much more energy. Surprises you. And when you are doing anything, if it's doing some services, give it everything you've got. If you're just having to wash the robes, just wash it with everything you've got. Do it carefully. Do it with full attention, full mindfulness. Develop energy. And then you sort of find you're overcoming this sloppiness of the mind called tinamita. When the mind gets really sloppy, it can't even keep its hut tidy. It's just too much work. It's just too much of a grind. If you want to get into that sort of state, you know, Ajahn Jaffa used to say this, you get reborn in your next life as a slug. It just sort of drags its body around really slowly, just so heavy, just full of tinamita. So I don't recommend being reborn as a slug, so put energy into this practice, energy into your whatever you're doing. Give it everything you've got. I was a young monk who was quite energetic. Whatever I did put a lot of energy and effort into it. And because of that, I did a lot. And also because of that, my meditation was bright and sharp. The amount of energy which you generate gives the brightness of the mind, gives the happiness of the mind. And when I talk in meditation about developing the perception of the beautiful breath, you won't be able to do that if you're dull and sleepy. You have to develop the energy, the brightness, the sharpness, the clarity of the mind. So tinamita is that dullness and lack of energy is a problem. Just do something about it. Make some action. Get up early in the morning. More walking meditation. Fast walking. Whatever it is which gets the blood moving, which gets the mind sharp. If the mind is very dull during the day, then do like some of the counting exercises or do some chanting. Do it fast to get the mind working. Read a sutta to inspire it. Give it energy. Give it happiness. Whatever it is to give that joy to the mind, which is energy. Otherwise, you just waste so much time just in dullness, in lethargy, and you're not getting anywhere. Time is precious, not to be wasted. The restlessness and remorse. Remorse is the result of bad actions of body, speech, or even mind, of bad karma. And it's true that if one doesn't keep a very high standard of sila, of morality, of virtue, keeping one's precepts, you find that remorse does come into the mind and does hinder the practice of meditation. It gives you some more business to deal with. You're not free. There is such a thing as conscience comes up, especially in a good monastery like this. If you do anything which is wrong, which is bad, which is against your precepts, that remorse is going to come up and it's going to stop you gaining any of the happiness in meditation. It's certainly going to stop you gaining the insights which lead to enlightenment. That's why the Buddha laid down these precepts. And that's why anyone who undertakes these precepts should keep them spotlessly. Yesterday when the monks were chanting their Patimokkha, we finished with the stanzas of a monk who trained themselves in the Patimokkha precepts, seeing danger in the slightest faults. And that's the danger in these faults, just the remorse which comes up if one breaks one's precepts. The remorse which is a hindrance which stops the meditation. And of course the way to overcome that remorse is through, one, acknowledgement, forgiveness, letting go, and resolving never to do it again. And if you can do that, you've let go of the hindrance. And especially resolving never to do it again, keeping a very high and pure standard of virtue, removes that hindrance. The restlessness is always coming from the fault-finding mind. The fault-finding mind always stops the contentment, which is the opposite of restlessness. And I use that term, the fault-finding mind, very often in my talks, simply because restlessness is another big hindrance to people's meditation. Why is it that they sit down and they just cannot get still? Why is it the thoughts come backwards and forwards and they can never overcome those thoughts? Why is it even in the deeper states of meditation they can watch the breath but they can't let go of the breath? The reason is they're just still too restless. They're still, whatever they're looking at now is not good enough for them. So they always want something else. When will there be an end of all this coming and going called restlessness? When will you find contentment? Will you find contentment in some other place, in some other time, in some other body, with some other mind state? If you think it's the fault of the place, the fault of the mind state, then you're sort of chasing your tail. You'll never find contentment that way. Contentment has to be found in the moment with what you've got. So no matter what stage you are in the meditation, you just say, no running backwards and forwards. I'm going to build my contentment here. No fault finding, no looking for something else, but to be happy, grateful with what I have. To appreciate this moment. So much so that the mind doesn't wander anywhere else. So much so that there's nothing to say. You ever notice that all thoughts are because of the perception of inadequacy in the present moment? When that perception of inadequacy is overcome, there's just nothing to think about. There's no problems. There's nothing to be done. There's nothing missing. There's just no problem. When there's no problem, there's no thought. But it is a problem, you might say. It's just one way of looking, fault-finding. The other way of looking is the perception of the beautiful, perception of contentment. And when you can start developing that perception of contentment, no matter what stage of meditation you're at, it just leads to the deepening and the deepening of the meditation. If you really are content, you've got nothing to think about. If you're really content, the future and the past doesn't interest you because you're just too happy being now. If you're really content, there is no future or past. If you're really content, you're just with the breath. Everything else disappears because you're just content being with this one bit of breath happening now. How you experience it, you're just content with as it is. You're not trying to judge it, not trying to compare. That's fault finding. So when you suspend all fault finding, instead you find contentment. And the whole practice of meditation is the deepening of that contentment. Starts with contentment in the present moment, that deepens into silence, that deepens into the perception of the breath. As you're just content with this one bit of breath happening now, it deepens into a beautiful breath. It happens all by itself. You don't go being fault-finding with this ordinary breath, saying it's not beautiful enough. The beautiful breath never happens that way. That's just ill will. That's just the cause of restlessness. You're just completely happy with this ordinary breath. So content that it soon develops into the beautiful breath. Each of the stages of meditation is within the one you're in now. You don't have to move to the left or right. You don't have to throw away this moment, neglect it, pass over it. Just go deeper in to the moment with deeper contentment. This is what we mean by the leaf becoming still. Every bit of fault finding, just you make the leaf vibrate even stronger. That restlessness is extremely important as a hindrance in the deeper stages of meditation. The contentment has to get so strong, so just happy, even just with being with a beautiful breath, you're not waiting or wondering when the nibbata is going to happen. You're just fully content with the beautiful breath. If you're 99% content with the beautiful breath, but 1% is hanging out for the nibbata, it will never come. You've got to give up all wanting for a nibbata, all desire for those things, and just go for contentment where you are. And then you'll experience a nimitta arising right within the beautiful breath. And again, contentment has to be maintained. Any bit of restlessness, then the nimitta will vanish completely. Or if it's just a tiny bit of restlessness, the nimitta will be there, but it'll be just too wobbly, just moving backwards and forwards, never really able to sustain itself. And as I've said before, the reason is that at that stage you're just watching a reflection of the observer, the mind. The observer, the mind moves, and so does the image. It's not so much the nimitta moving as you're moving. So let the observer be still. How does the observer stay still? Just contentment. Let go. No fault finding. This is good enough. With that degree of wisdom, with that degree of contentment, you'll find the nimitta just gets brighter and brighter, bigger and bigger, until it envelops you. And then you know what jhanas are about. Not only do you know what jhanas are about, but you know what restlessness is about. Just the movement of the mind. It is, what I say, the last of the hindrances to be overcome. So be careful to know restlessness. The last of the hindrances in the list, though, is vichikicca, the doubt. And that doubt is another form of restlessness which makes the mind move backwards and forwards. That doubt is overcome by faith, by confidence in the instructions, in the Dhamma, confidence in one's own ability. You all know that if you start to doubt, each of the stages of meditation is within the one you're in now. You don't have to move to the left or right. You don't have to throw away this moment, neglect it, pass over it. Just go deeper in to the moment with deeper contentment. This is what we mean by the leaf becoming still. Every bit of fault finding, just you make the leaf vibrate even stronger. That restlessness is extremely important as a hindrance in the deeper stages of meditation. The contentment has to get so strong, so just happy, even just with being with a beautiful breath, you're not waiting or wondering when the nibbata is going to happen. You're just fully content with the beautiful breath. If you're 99% content with the beautiful breath, but 1% is hanging out for the nibbata, it will never come. You've got to give up all wanting for a nibbata, all desire for those things, and just go for contentment where you are. And then you'll experience a nimitta arising right within the beautiful breath. And again, contentment has to be maintained. Any bit of restlessness, then the nimitta will vanish completely. Or if it's just a tiny bit of restlessness, the nimitta will be there, but it'll be just too wobbly, just moving backwards and forwards, never really able to sustain itself. And as I said before, the reason is that at that stage you're just watching a reflection of the observer, the mind. The observer, the mind moves, then so does the image. It's not so much the nimitta moving, it's your moving. So let the observer be still. How does the observer stay still? Just contentment. Let go. No fault finding. This is good enough. With that degree of wisdom, with that degree of contentment, you'll find the nimitta just gets brighter and brighter, bigger and bigger, until it envelops you. And then you know what jhanas are about. Not only do you know what jhanas are about, but you know what restlessness is about. Just the movement of the mind. It is, what I say, the last of the hindrances to be overcome. So be careful to know restlessness. The last of the hindrances in the list, though, is vichikicca, the doubt. And that doubt is another form of restlessness which makes the mind move backwards and forwards. That doubt is overcome by faith, by confidence in the instructions, in the Dhamma, confidence in one's own ability. You all know that if you start to doubt your own ability, for whatever reason you think you're not up to it, you know that then you're lost then. That is a hindrance, it's an obstacle to the success in meditation. So the doubt, can I not, no I can't do it. There's no way you can do it then. Those of you who don't believe me, that's more doubt. You just get caught in this doubt. So you do need a degree of confidence and faith, if not in me, then in the word of the Buddha, in the suttas. This is the way to enlightenment. It's only people who have killed their parents, who have raped a bhikkhuni, caused a schism in the Sangha, shed the blood of a Tathagata, those are the only people who can't become enlightened, who can't gain jhanas. So have confidence that it's possible. Build up that faith, because without it, it's not possible. It's lack of faith, vichikicca, just self-sustains itself, it justifies itself. When you have doubt, I can't do it, there you are, I was right. So challenge that vichikicca. There's also that doubt comes up towards the path. Remember the clear instructions, so that you always know what to do next. You always know what these hindrances are, you know how they're overcome. You can recognize the obstacles to meditation. So at least don't have doubt as towards the path, especially not the path of meditation. If you have a bit of uncertainty about the teachings, the instructions, then do more reflection at the end of every meditation to see, well, what did I do? What worked? So you know for yourself, for your own experience, or your own wisdom, what works, what the path is to deep meditation. You should know it means a lot of faith, I can do it. It means a lot of letting go of contentment. It means a lot of trust. It means a lot of energy. These are the things which you know are necessary. So have confidence in your own wisdom in these areas. If you haven't got enough experience then trust those who have experience. And there comes a time when you have to give confidence, complete confidence to the process. This is what we mean by letting go. Sometimes when we haven't got enough confidence, not enough trust, we doubt what would happen if I really let go. If I just let the process happen rather than controlling it. That last fine piece of doubt also has to be recognized and overcome. So often that people can get halfway in the meditation, they can start watching the breath, but they still have to keep controlling it. They're a bit scared about what would happen if they really let go, if they weren't in control. They doubt the ability of the process to look after them. Have a bit of confidence and faith. Overcome that doubt by being courageous, by just taking that one step into uncertainty, by letting go of the doer, the controller, the manipulator. And when these experiences come up, don't go doubting them, thinking about them, is this a nimitta, is this not a nimitta? And sometimes when those nimittas first come up, sometimes it is hard to recognize them. And sometimes doubt comes along, and as soon as you start doubting, thinking again, nimittas disappear and vanish. The time for all assessment is at the end of the meditation, not at the middle of it. Time for working out what happened comes at the end of the experiment, not in the middle. So leave all that doubt, is this jhana, is this a nimitta, is this a beautiful breath? Leave all that doubt, which is more restlessness, until the end. Just develop more and more contentment, more and more letting go, more and more peace, more and more stopping. And get rid of that skepticism and that doubting, which is again another aspect of the controller. So please recognize these hindrances to the meditation. These are hindrances also to insight. Recognize them, know them well, reflect upon them on your meditation path, when you're sitting meditation. Any obstacle which happens in the meditation, the Buddha said, will be one of these five hindrances or a combination of them. Don't just waste your time meditating and getting nowhere. Meditate, see what the obstacle is, find out what hindrance it is, and then apply the antidote. If you do that, you become a skillful meditator, a methodical meditator, one who doesn't waste time, and one who gains the goal of this meditation. There's 6 more weeks left of this rains retreat. It would be such a shame to waste it by coming across obstacles and just not knowing what to do next. Remember these 5 hindrances. Use them as a framework for seeing what the problem is. Just like a mechanic who is faced with a car which doesn't work can go through the manual, knowing the 5 things to look at to check to see what's wrong. Check these things, and then you find your meditation will become far deeper, more successful, and your insights too will be far more deep, far more successful, which means your chances to gain the paths and fruits, the jhanas, the whole works, will increase enormously. So please remember the 5 hindrances and a way to apply them to gain deeper and more powerful meditation. So that's the talk for this evening. Is there any questions or comments?
It doesn't really matter, because even if you have that doubt, you still apply the condition that eventually you rise on those things. So it's just good practice to put those conditions into place. And the Buddha actually said that, you know, that if you actually practice it, or apart from the jhana and the power, it actually results in that practice.
Indeed, that if your doubts aren't that strong, then you still keep going because of a bit of faith. But sometimes the doubt becomes so strong they even give up trying. I'm not quite sure if this really does lead to enlightenment or not, or whether this is the right thing I should be doing. So you don't give it the full effort, which full confidence will generate. when a person has doubt, is this the right way, is this the wrong way, they tend to sort of dither and they don't sort of make much progress. So that is one of the problems with the doubt. And you see some people sort of doubt so much they don't give anything a try. Does that make sense to you? Okay, finish for today.
Samaha.